Hey everybody, Danielle here. Just before we get started with this episode, I wanted to put a little content warning. If you didn't notice on this episode's little title, you should have seen the little E symbol for explicit. This is a rated R movie with a lot of very mature content, and we just decided to be safe. We're going to go ahead and mark this episode explicit. And because we're doing that, I left all of our cursing uncensored, as it usually is. So I just wanted to give you a little heads up before going in that, you know, if you usually listen to this around your kids and have it just playing in the house, this might not be the episode to do that. Maybe click on a different episode if you've got kids in the room. But this one's really, really fun, and I hope you guys enjoy it. Welcome back to Banter Box, a review podcast run by the team here at Mad Artists. Each week, we will be reviewing a different production, whether it's a movie, TV show, whatever we're feeling like. And this week, we watched The Shape of Water. My name is Danielle, and here are the Mad Artists that I have with me to help break this down today.
As always, it is Samuel.
It's John.
And it's me, Tyler.
All right, guys. So, first off, before we jump into this movie, we actually have our first little, I guess, fan segment from our good friend, Rick Harper. He sent us an email just talking about, you know, everything with the show and, you know, giving us some feedback. And he gave us a couple of cool things about Die Hard from last week. So here's a little Die Hard Revisited from Rick. I'm just going to read what he sent here in the email. Of course, I saw Die Hard in the theater when I was in college so many years ago. I also then managed to get it on VHS tape and watched it on repeat just hundreds of times. One thing you probably didn't know was that at that time, Bruce Willis was primarily a comedic actor. He was famous for Moonlighting, which was a sort of rom-com detective show, so him showing up in an action flick was totally new for him, but boy did it launch him into the stratosphere. I also think that this was reflected in a lot of your comments on the podcast about how great his reactions were. And did you guys not uncover the trivia about how they dropped Alan Rickman on 2 instead of 3 out the window to give him an extra surprised look on his face? I thought that was pretty cool.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
Him out of the window.
I guess they dropped him.
Either on a cable or onto a pad.
I'm sure. Something like that.
Horrifying with that.
You're so ready.
Like, you're already nervous about being dropped. You're like, this is going to. Okay, I could do this.
Just imagine just like looking at the stunt choreographer in the eyes, like, all right, we're going to push you off on 3. All right, got it. Cool. 3. All right. 1, 2.
That would have been so scary.
But a big thank you to Rick for reaching out to us. He's super awesome. He's worked with us on a few projects, and we hope he's going to keep working with us.
And hey, I believe he sent him some requests that we're going to do in the future.
Did.
And Rick, if you're listening, you should come on and join us.
Yes, I'm going to ask him to come on. He requested a few different things, including a movie that Sam and I both really love, Groundhog Day, that we should do. So I'm hoping we can get him to come on and join us for some of those.
That's crazy, because that Groundhog Day is a lot of things, but Garth Marenghi's Dark Place isn't one of them. That's one that I've been holding out for quite some time.
You've been waiting for that to get pulled out of the
it's
hat.
It's going to be so great when it happens.
Here's the thing. I went like months without getting a single one of my movies pulled from the hat.
Really?
And then got like 2 of them in the space of 3 weeks. So, you know.
That's what his hat pulled.
You'll go months without getting one.
You did also get Cool as Ice right off the bat.
I did. And I'm very grateful for that.
Because I remember,
really,
I think both of them were bitter because they were like, Tyler just immediately get his pick.
I mean, at least Samuel's gotten 2 drawn. I think I've only had the 1 drawn, which
was
Tombstone.
Yeah. Well,
wait, really? You've been doing this for a year.
And
for the record,
one
we also did go through some of our like previous members' picks that are no longer with us, and so like those also kind of
they are still
the
alive.
Job.
For the record,
no, they're not. They're not dead.
That's how we get new members here, guys. We just off them and just act like nothing happened.
Hi, Tyler.
As soon as they get bored of me, please send help. Call 911.
You'll hear
from
Tyler in a few
weeks. Circumstances of your death. It wasn't an accident.
In other news, Russell has been gone for a couple of weeks.
Oh, Lord.
Russell will be back for all you Russell lovers out there. Yes. He's just on vacation.
I started blinking Morse code, help in Morse code, but then I remembered that this is just an audio
this
podcast.
This is an audio media.
Morse code. Morse code.
Help.
Well, so first impressions. Had anyone seen this before or knew anything about it?
No, but goodness, I do love the vibe that it created from the get-go.
So I knew two things about this movie. Actually, three. I knew it was directed by Guillermo del Toro. I knew that it won Best Picture at the Oscars. And I knew that it contained fish porn.
Everything Samuel just said is kind of my exposure to it. I knew that it was big. I knew a lot of people liked it. And I knew fish porn. And that's literally all that I knew going into it. But I kept an open mind. And we were, at least I was rewarded for it. Yeah. It's very, yeah. very good.
So I remember there being tons of commercials for this, because I remember when this came out, and I saw, like, the trailer for it, I saw all this stuff, and all I could think was, this looks weird as crap. What? Samuel!
Oh my gosh.
It happened again, ladies and gentlemen. We are starting off 2022 with a classic
first episode
Samuel
since
sound
the anniversary. Danielle had just complimented you last episode.
I had just said how you gotten so good about not doing what you're doing currently.
No, it's fine.
Is
but,
it?
But what happens if you're over 40 and are struggling with erectile dysfunction? What do we do? What do they do?
Have mesothelioma.
We can't say because they're not sponsoring us.
Oh, that's true. They're not sponsoring us.
Call a doctor, figure it the hell out.
Call a doctor, get it fixed.
Anywho,
back to fish porn.
Yes, back to fish porn. So I remember it coming out, and I remember seeing the commercials and thinking that it looked really weird, that it basically just looked like an aquatic romance. I didn't gather any violence from it at all.
Yeah, this was way more action-y than I was.
Yeah, I was not expecting it. I thought it was just going to be, like, really sappy romance the whole time. So I was pleasantly surprised in that regard, for sure. I was not expecting it. Oh, God. What?
I'm sorry. My brain is just weird and strange. And you're just talking about a really sappy romance, and I'm just imagining this being a different movie where she's just like, I'm a human and you're a fish person, but I love you. And he's just like, I don't know
why. Oh, Lord.
I think that's the movie we deserve. We don't deserve this movie. We deserve that film.
That's the Mel Brooks version of this movie.
That's true.
So this came out in 2017. It was directed by Guillermo del Toro and also written by him and Vanessa Taylor, and stars Sally Hawkins as Eliza Esposito and Octavia Spencer as Zelda Fuller. I didn't know who to put as the other, like, starring character, but Octavia Spencer's amazing, so I chose her. You can watch this with a Sling TV or Hulu Premium subscription, or you can buy or rent it on Vudu, Apple TV, YouTube, Prime Video, or Google Play. And the IMDb summary for this says, at a top secret research facility in the 1960s, a lonely janitor forms a unique relationship with an amphibious creature that is being held in captivity. Samuel.
So, Guillermo del Toro is one of the most prolific directors of the modern age, I'd say. Very well known for a lot of his different movies. His filmography was actually a little shorter than I remember it being, for somebody who has big of a name.
Mm-hmm.
He directed Blade 2.
He did?
Yeah, he directed Blade 2. He directed the original Hellboy movies.
Yeah, that I knew.
The first two Hellboy movies, and he wrote those as well.
He directed Blade 2?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Yeah. Of course, that was the movie that shot him in the mainstream. Of course, Pan's Labyrinth, which we were going to do this week,
but we're going to wait on Russell next.
Yep. Yes. Yep, we're going to wait on Russell for that. Pacific Rim.
Oh, yeah. Oh. I've cited that movie a few times on the podcast.
And then a movie that I've seen and I've wanted to watch, so but I did not realize was Del Toro, Crimson Peak.
I haven't seen it, but I really want to.
And coming up next from Guillermo del Toro in 2022 is his take on Pinocchio.
Oh.
Oh, God. That's going to be... Really?
I'm intrigued.
Our writer Vanessa Taylor has a very short and mixed filmography. She wrote four episodes of Game of Thrones.
Which four?
I didn't write that
only
down.
Four.
Oh, I wish
she wrote Divergent.
Oh no.
She was an uncredited writer on Aladdin, the new one.
Oh.
And she wrote most recently Hillbilly Elegy. Hillbilly Elegy. It was a very
Hillbilly-ology?
Hillbilly Elegy.
Oh, Elegy. What?
It was a very, very well received movie that came out last year.
Hillbilly Elegy?
Yeah, what?
Hillbilly Elegy.
I mean, okay.
It was a very, very well received movie that came out, I think, early in 2021.
What the hell?
This isn't a question for Samuel. This is a question for John and Tyler. This is not super related, but am I the only one who, when I hear the word hillbilly, I just think of that segment on The Amanda Show?
It's time for a hillbilly moment.
I just think of the Beverly Hillbillies.
I love it. That's, I would say that's where mine goes.
The Beverly Hillbillies. Big fish, that big fish who? I'm going to hit you in the head with a big fish.
That's,
huh?
That's all I ever think of when I hear the word hillbilly every time.
Dan Schneider is a problem.
He's a problem. He's a problem. Problem. Unfortunately, his work permeates so many of our childhoods now.
That's correct.
It's so unfortunate.
Big fan of the feet.
Gosh, we're not going to get into
that. Nope, we're not doing that.
Our new podcast project. Stop. Let's talk about Dan Schneider.
No!
Tyler will not be here next week.
Is there anything y'all would like to talk about as far as overarching stuff before we dive into the plot summary?
The atmosphere is so good.
It's fabulous. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Like, me and Tyler reference it multiple times throughout the movie, but if you love the game, the original BioShock, this gives off that vibe hardcore.
Yeah.
It's delightful, and that's what made, in my opinion, the BioShock game as good as it was the ambiance and atmosphere was all there for it. And it sets it up perfectly. Like, it's got that, like, weird, creepy marine aquatic vibe to it. Especially with the opening sequence being, or the title sequence being underwater.
As artsy as you can get.
Yeah, right. It was very, very artistic. One thing that, I mean, they've already talked about the artistic kind of style of the movie. One of the things that really, like, it took me a second to kind of mold over was how they handled the, for lack of a better term, the problematic themes that come with 1960s America.
Yeah.
I was absolutely just staggered and blown away by how ingrained into the world certain things were, but it didn't felt preachy, like, hey, back then was racist. It didn't feel like that. It didn't feel like it was making that point as much as it was, we're taking a snapshot.
Just a reminder. Almost like a, if you didn't realize when this was set.
Right.
To me, every time
it happened, it almost like was a little bit of a shock. Right. Where it was that moment of you're just watching a movie and you're not thinking anything about it, and then you're like, oh yeah, this was in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It brings you back to that time period, and you're just like, wow.
I mean, and everybody's just so casual about it, just so chill. Nobody's over the top about it. Mm-hmm. Just very...
Save for one fake Southern individual.
Yes, the guy in the pie shop, Mr.
FBI.
Well,
man.
But even he wasn't over the top in terms of like being like all like yelling. He was like, "You can't sit there. You got to take it out." And then he was talking there, and he's all like, "Yeah, I need you to leave. We're a family restaurant."
Yeah,
like he wasn't like yelling and screaming and calling them all kinds of slurs. He was just very like, "This is ingrained in his life as
this is how he lives day to day."
I mean, it seemed to me from the point of the movie, especially with now being able to reflect on it after X amount of hours of seeing it. It really is a point out or call out, because in the opening monologue she mentions, you know, the classic stereotype of who's really the monster in this situation, the man or this fish person who we'll meet later, and it's really pointing out the barbarism of humanity in and of itself, and it shows that in brief flashbacks, and you also get some of the negligence of society in that fact, because we have one scene, I don't remember where it is, but her friend, he's watching TV and only wants to watch entertainment value, but whenever she turns the news to the riots in the streets
with them hosing him down with fire hoses,
he is
like,
adamantly like,
turn it off,
change it, I don't want to see it. And it just shows the negligence of society at that point.
Yep.
Well, also, I think
maybe a little more me than you.
Wait, what?
When he's talking about how we're all made in God's image, and he's like, well,
yeah.
He's like, or even you. Well, maybe a little more me than you.
It was so, like, oh my god, it was subtle, but it was also like, just, it just felt very fluid and it felt very natural in a striking kind of oh my god way. Also, I think if you like Hunchback of Notre Dame, you're gonna really like this movie, because there are a lot of similar themes that they talk about. And I think that was pretty cool.
So there's one thing I want to get ahead of really quick, because this also played into most of the negative reviews included this whole thing. A lot of people who just don't get it like to say that this is like condoning bestiality or something crazy.
Stop.
And I just want to—I want to preface this with they state that this, you know, creature is a god. He's, you know, referred to as an amphibious man. And honestly, I see it as like a more realistic look of if merpeople existed. This is probably what they would actually look
more
like.
More close to what they'd actually
look. So if you want to go and say this is bestiality, look at The Little Mermaid again and see what you think.
Yeah.
Also, that is being said just as a preface warning for those of you with children and are thinking about seeing this movie. It has nudity in it. Don't.
Don't.
Yeah.
This is rated R and it's meant to be rated R.
12 under shouldn't see it. 12 under.
I would say like 16 and under.
Honestly, 15 and under. Well, you can't control what parents fucking show their kids. I curse.
John, that's like one of your first ones ever.
I know.
Wow.
You should.
Hey, hey, parents, watch your beep, kids.
You should. You can't. Because trust me, I worked at GameStop for years. You can't control what parents decide to show their kids. I had 13-year-olds' parents telling them it's okay for them to buy GTA 5. I just had to sit there and be like, okay.
The kid has to learn.
I would recommend like 16 is maybe fine.
Yeah, 16.
15 and under is probably a no-go.
No-go.
Unless the MPAA really cool says not to watch it unless you're 17.
Unless
so.
You're a cool
like
parent.
Like 16, 17 is where like the beginning of okay, it's fine. Is.
All I'm saying is I watched Die Hard when I was like 11 or 12 and I wanted to kiss the fish, man. I don't know if that's connected, but you
Die Hard and Fish
choice.
Man, yep.
If you watch Die Hard at age 11, you will be attracted to the amphibious man.
If you're exposed to adult themes earlier, you're more open-minded about interspecies fish fornication.
I don't know where we're going at this point.
Fishman loves eggs.
He does love eggs. He does
I want that sound bite. I want that sound bite.
Oh, boy.
I want that sound bite.
Oh, God. Okay. So, diving into this plot summary.
We should
summary.
Start letting Tyler edit these so he can pull all the sound bites
away. So he can pull the sound bites away. I'd be afraid that I Want Your Blood would just be sprinkled in randomly throughout the podcast.
I Want Your Blood. Fishmen love eggs.
Oh, gosh.
This is a degenerate podcast. This is what this movie does to us.
This is what it's done. But yeah, I will... Yeah, I will just say, as far as, like, if you're wondering why it's rated R, there's a lot of violence, some kind of gory moments. There's obviously, you know, full nudity.
Like, full
Full female nudity. And then, like, some male nudity as well. There's a lot of sex that goes on. There's some self-pleasure that goes on. So there's a lot of stuff that entitles this to be rated R. So if you're considering, like, oh, is this safe for my kids? Maybe just think about it for a minute and decide if you want
the
your
answer
kids to be exposed
no.
to this.
No,
unless you're cool.
Unless it's, like, a teenage
Stop
kid
it.
And then maybe. But yeah, so let's dive into this plot here. So Eliza Esposito, who was found abandoned as an infant with wounds on her neck by the side of a river, is mute and communicates through sign language. By 1962, during the Cold War, Esposito works as a cleaner at a secret government laboratory in Baltimore, Maryland, and lives a very routine life. Her only friends are her closeted next-door neighbor, Giles, a middle-aged, struggling advertising illustrator, and her co-worker, Zelda Fuller. Both of who are wonderful characters and wonderful people in her life.
Can I make one note about Giles?
Yeah.
Richard Jenkins did a really good job.
Yeah.
The person who this role was written for would have killed this role so hard.
Who was it?
This role was written for Sir Ian McKellen.
Oh, wow.
Who was a closeted gay man in the 1960s.
Wow.
That would have been really good.
Unfortunately, I believe he's friends with Del Toro, but he had several movies contracted at the time. So he wasn't able to, I think Mr. Holmes actually was the one, which, I mean, that's a great movie too.
Dang.
But so he wasn't able to do Shape
really
of Water.
Good.
I mean,
but,
Del Toro, the,
wow.
like something in the fun facts.
Richard Jenkins did do a really good job.
He did a great job. He did a great job. So something in the fun facts that that I had was that Del Toro wrote this with almost all of the actors already cast in his mind. Like, he already knew who he wanted to play everybody.
Wow.
Like, you know, Sally Hawkins, like, already in his mind. The bad guy, already in his mind. Octavia Spencer, already in his mind. Like, all these people were already there. Which, Sam, what was it that you found out about Doug Jones when he got cast?
Oh, he had a panic attack when they told him he was going to be the... he was going to be the romantic lead, because he plays a lot of Guillermo del Toro's... He plays a lot of Guillermo del Toro's, like, creatures.
Really?
And monsters. That's what
he did a lot of Pan's Labyrinth,
yeah,
too.
He's a mime and a contortionist.
What?
And so he does all of, like, del Toro's creatures. So del Toro came to him and said, hey, you know, you're going to be playing this character in this new movie. And he was like, great. He said, oh, yeah, and you're going to be the romantic lead. And he had a panic attack.
Really? Oh my god, that's kind of awesome.
So
it's not awesome that
yeah.
he had a panic
no,
attack,
no.
but it's awesome that he handled that role with like a certain level of reverence with that. That's,
yeah,
that's cool.
I want to, before we go too much further, I do want to talk about that specifically, like just Doug Jones and everything, because before I found out kind of something about the suit, I was honestly, and I'm probably going to be the odd one out on this, pretty disappointed with the physicality. I expected more. Like, I didn't hate it. It wasn't bad, but I wanted more, like, unique kind of, you know, things that wasn't just the suit doing stuff, because that's kind of what it seemed like to me. It seemed like he was relying very heavily on the suit, and when I saw that he was, like, a contortionist and a mime and all this, I was even more disappointed, because I was like, that means that he can do stuff. But I looked up this article, and I want to read a snippet from it, because it kind of explained to me why... there wasn't as much, so...
Can I make a prediction before you say that?
Yeah.
Because I'm curious.
Yeah.
I would argue... I would guess the suit that they built for him was extremely restrictive and, like, super unmoving, and that was a product of the suit as opposed to his physicality. But that's my guess. I want to hear what...
To an extent, yes. So this was an article from Cinema Blend by Nick Evans. It was titled, "The Monster Suit Worn in the Shape of Water Sounds Like a Nightmare." And I just want to read a snippet of this, because when I read this, I felt better, because I was like, okay, so it's not the guy's fault.
Right.
So, frequent Guillermo del Toro's collaborator, Doug Jones, plays the amphibian man in The Shape of Water, and it sounds like wearing the suit for the role was far more nightmarish than any monster. A profile on the prolific actor described the laborious process involved in putting on and wearing the fishman costume. The suit itself took 3 hours to put on, and was so skin tight that Doug Jones had to literally use KY jelly just to get into it. Once on, the actor couldn't see at all through the eyes and the helmet and could barely hear, and yet still had to carry out a performance. To top it all off, according to the New York Times, the suit would soak up water like a sponge, becoming ridiculously heavy, and being a water creature, it was pretty much always wet. Walking around in wet clothes all day, except they're skin tight, you can't take them off, and you have to work in them? No, thank you. However, the lead creature designer and sculptor for The Shape of Water, Mike Hill, noted that the actor never complained about a process that I imagine many other actors would not have endured. In fact, when they needed a professional dancer to be a body double for a dance sequence, it quickly became apparent just how brutal wearing the suit was, as Guillermo del Toro explained, and this is a quote from Del Toro, "He got into the suit, did one pirouette, and then proceeded to projectile vomit." That was the dance double, the second he was in that suit. It also proves that not just anyone can put on a costume like that and perform. So I no longer am judging that guy for his like movement and stuff.
<That's>
I read
incredible.
That and I was like, okay, he did far
what
better
he,
than
right.
anyone else probably
yeah.
could have with
that's
that suit.
That's actually incredible.
So shout out to Doug Jones. I apologize for doubting you. I'm sure you're fantastic, and we're going to see you again in Pan's Labyrinth, so I'm excited for that. But I wanted to get that out of the way, because that was something that bothered me the whole time I was watching the movie, but then I saw that article and it made me feel a lot better.
Also, Doug, thanks for listening. Thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, Doug, we know you've been tuning in since day one, and now we're finally doing one of your movies.
Watch that actually be true.
Oh, God. I'd be so stressed.
Email from Doug Jones next instead of Rick.
Ooh, Banter Box is out.
Oh, God.
What's up, Doug?
Lord. Oh, what a weird connection that would be. But yeah, so Colonel Richard Strickland has just captured a mysterious creature from a South American river and has taken the creature to the Baltimore facility for further study. Curious about the creature, Eliza discovers it is a humanoid amphibian. She begins visiting him in secret, and the two form a close bond.
Over eggs, yes.
She brings him eggs, which I kept expecting that to, like, come back at some point, because you know when Strickland like finds the egg there, mm-hmm. I thought that like maybe later, like, you know, he would see her like eating her lunch and it was eggs.
Yeah, I thought that was gonna
He was gonna be like, oh, it was her, and figure it out like from that or something.
But it really didn't matter at all.
It didn't matter at all.
I didn't know how stupid they were gonna play Strickland, because we were still like learning his character. So when he saw the egg, I didn't know if he was gonna be like, what are you laying eggs, Mr. Fishman? Like, I thought that was the route he was gonna go. And then he was just like, oh, egg. And then he just throws it away.
Tosses it.
Wait, what?
So then why was that important?
Like, what's going on?
No, there were some moments with Strickland. I don't know if it's going to go into it in this summary, but some of the moments that interested me the most were just him living his life, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, the whole Cadillac shop scene was like awesome. Enthralling to me.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Awesome.
I loved that scene.
Salesman killed it.
And it was even, so it was a whole thing. You see that he is so big on this positive mindset. He's reading a book that's like The Positive Mind or something like mm-hmm. that. And at one point he's telling the guy, like, I can't be in a negative headspace. And he comes home and he's so like negative.
Yeah.
Clearly, but his family is the happiest, cheeriest family you've ever seen. His wife is like, let's go upstairs and bang. His kids are like, we love you, and like all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And he's just sitting there, this dark cloud, like, I can't be in a negative headspace. And I'm like, you're not. You're in the best headspace with your family.
I really, really like Strickland's character. I don't like the person, but
the character is
extremely compelling, because I feel like he is a microcosm of that 1960s male mentality.
Well, mm-hmm. and that the Cadillac scene perfectly showed it.
Oh, yeah.
Because it, you know, when Strickland's first introduced, especially in that scene where he feels like, you know, he has the power with the girls in the bathroom, he's so overwhelming and so powerful, and you feel like this guy owns the room.
Mm-hmm.
And then he walks into the Cadillac shop, and the salesman sees everything, reads mm-hmm. him like that, and he is wrapped around the salesman's finger.
Mm-hmm.
The salesman knows exactly what kind of man he is, and in that scenario, the salesman has all the power.
Yep.
And sells the car to him by telling him that, oh, this is going to give you more power.
Yeah.
And it's just brilliant.
Man, salespeople mm-hmm. are so cool.
It shows you... Shut up, Tyler. It shows you just how...
I honestly kept looking at you during that scene. Like, I
wonder who we're going to cast Tyler as.
Cadillac no. salesman.
It really shows, that scene's the perfect microcosm of the weakness of his character. It's so good. So mm-hmm. good.
Yeah, and it was just really, really dope that the salesman showed up spinning on the platform above him.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought the platform trick
and
was
And he
cool.
never even, like, but, answered any of Strickland's questions
right,
that he would
yeah.
ask. He would just continue and say, this is the car for you, and just keep going, and just put him in the car,
yeah.
and then he just left with
like,
the car. And
I
was
like,
and
it's green. And he's like, it's not green, it's teal. That's 14 colors there working together, my guy. Sit in the car. You're a strong,
and then,
man,
and then
aren't
he
you?
Just,
You're
and then
a big
he,
boy, aren't you, you little big boy?
And then
he
just
like, okay, I'll buy it.
And then Strickland just parrots it back to everybody else.
And he goes in there. He's like, nice green car. He's like, it's teal. And then shuts mm-hmm. the door. But like, park the car scene. Oh, wow. That's a sentence.
Park the car scene.
No, what? From the family dynamic to the way in which he was portrayed, I do think that he is like the best snapshot of that toxic masculine
mm-hmm.
1960s.
Oh, of course.
Hardcore.
Just hardcore, like the illusions and in one case, like actual demonstration of sexual misconduct,
mm-hmm.
the way in which that he treats the, you know, the African
American
person.
I mean, that's just a snapshot of like how
and
you know men in that era could get away with anything.
Yeah,
like,
I mean he's got the white picket fence
mm-hmm.
family. The wife is like just an actual like person. They went back in time and just found someone from the 1960s because she is the most that I've ever seen.
The most 1960s.
Like, it's actually insane just how well and how detailed they captured that, but not in a way that was, like, even though it's the most defined version of what I would assume that is, it wasn't a caricature.
Yeah, it wasn't, parodic? What's the word?
It wasn't a parody.
It wasn't a parody. Yeah. There's another word. But yeah, it wasn't a parody at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved all of that.
This movie handles a lot of its social issues or points in such a subtle and artistic way that it doesn't make it feel like the film is solely about, you know, this particular agenda.
Yeah.
It's subtle enough to where, like, hey, this is a problem. All right, now back to Fishman.
Which is very rare in modern movies.
Now back to Fishman.
Now back to the fish plot.
He loves eggs.
Oh, Lord. John. Well, we're going to move on. So,
seeking... He does love eggs, though.
It's true.
Seeking to exploit the amphibian man for U.S. advantage in the space race, General Frank Hoyt is eventually persuaded by Strickland to vivisect it. Dr. Robert Hofstadler, a scientist who is secretly a Russian spy named Dmitry Mosenkov, I believe is how you
Dmitry
say it.
Moscow.
Dmitry Moscow. Pleads unsuccessfully to keep the amphibian man alive for further study and is simultaneously ordered by his Soviet handlers to euthanize the creature. Yes? Where do you guys...
I was like Dmitry Moscow, haha, he's Russian, and John looks directly at me and just goes, Mazel Tov. Which isn't Russian, it's Jewish. Yeah. Or Hebrew.
Jewish language.
I love the fact that I happen to look directly at you. God dang.
Oh my god.
Are you guys gonna be okay?
Yeah, no, we're gonna be great.
I freaking hope so. It is parodic, by the way. I looked it up.
Oh, okay.
Parodic. No, I thought so.
You did good.
You had the right word.
Proud of you.
Well, when Eliza overhears the Americans' plans for the amphibian man, she persuades Giles to help her liberate him. Hofstadler stumbles upon Eliza's plot in progress and chooses to assist her. Though initially reluctant, Zelda also becomes involved in making the escape successful.
She kind of had no choice.
She really didn't at that point. She was like, all right, it's either I help you or we get caught and it's all bad. So, mm-hmm. like, let's just make something good out of it. No, I loved Zelda. She really came in clutch for Eliza 24/7.
Yeah, she was a really grounded character, too.
She was incredible. Yeah, she was always the one, like, making sure Eliza was clocked in on time, making sure that, like, okay, I'm going to clock her out on time, you know.
Despite the insistent protest of Yolanda.
Yolanda
is always in the background, just getting mad at Zelda.
My favorite gag of the entire show is, shut up, Yolanda.
It was such a good and not overplayed gag. I enjoyed it.
I thought it was really cool how all of the main characters were disenfranchised people of that time period.
Yeah.
So you have someone who's mute, which is a disability. You have someone
And correct me if I'm wrong, but she was I might be wrong on this. Was she Hispanic? Latino?
So it doesn't say that she was.
I mean, Esposito.
Esposito is like sort of...
It's Mediterranean at the least.
Esposito is right. Some kind of... I believe it's a Spanish name, but it means exposed, and that's like why it's used, like he said, describe orphans.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't think, I mean, that's clearly not her family name.
Yeah, there were a couple of references that made me question whether she was Latino or not, and then the name and all, so I just wasn't sure. But.
Yeah, but I mean, I think moreover that, you know, her kind of disenfranchised identity was her disability.
Yeah.
Then you have someone who's a closeted homosexual. Then you have someone who's black in 1960, and then you have a Russian spy who's more scientist than spy.
Yeah,
which was just really cool, and they all came together because there was just this quiet understanding of each other against the societal norms of the time and the, you know, both
societal norms. And it helped all of them understand the creature.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was such an interesting change to see a, like, Russian spy character played as a hero.
Yeah.
It was a very interesting change. Because when he's shown to be a spy, you're like, oh, he's a bad guy. Mm-hmm. But then you see that he actually also wants to save the amphibian man. And he's like, no, I care more about this creature who is unique and beautiful being able to live than, you know, completing my mission.
Yeah, he's like, I'm a scientist first and like a spy second. And I'm like, that's so cool.
That's a very interesting change, especially from our last week Russians. Or Germans. Not Russians.
Yeah.
They were Germans.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all
Hashtag Samuel is over party.
Hashtag Samuel is canceled.
Hashtag Samuel starts World War III.
What is that, Avenue Q? What do you think? We all look the same to you?
Oh, Lord. All right. Well, anyway, so after that, after Eliza... good Lord. So Eliza plans to release the amphibian man into a nearby canal when heavy rain will allow access to the ocean. In the meantime, she keeps him in her bathtub. Strickland interrogates Eliza and Zelda, among others, but he learns nothing. Back at the... Which... I was obsessed with that scene where he interrogated both of them, where he brought them in. And he sits there and he explains what the word trivial means. Mm-hmm. And so they keep throwing back the, like,
the words that he's using.
Like Zelda is like, something trivial. And then you see, like, Eliza sign the word trivial to him.
Yeah.
And then she just signs, like, F you as she's leaving. And he's like, what is she saying? And Zelda's just like, she's saying thank you. Yeah. Oh, I thought it was great. Oh, it was so good.
Yeah.
It's
handled really well, too, because I feel like other filmmakers. And we haven't gotten to that part, I'm sorry, but
we're jumping all around.
There's a part where Strickland.
Yeah.
Strickland. There's a part where Strickland, which just that name's really on the nose. There's a part where Strickland was, you know, making moves on Eliza, and I'm like, oh God, they were alluding to it, and now it's happening, and here we go. And I feel like other filmmakers would have just done a full like assault scene.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad that they didn't.
Yeah. I was worried I feel like for that a second.
Because really it got the point across without, having to go there.
Right. And I feel like, and I'm not sitting here saying, you can't show that, you can't do that. I'm not saying that. I just think that in this specific movie would have really compromised the tone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really glad that they made that choice. Because in some movies, it would be really, like, gripping and visceral, and it would add to a more gloomy or serious tone.
Yeah.
I think that was a great choice that they didn't, and...
Again, it's the subtlety of tackling these social issues.
They got the point across without having to compromise everything. Yeah.
Right.
Think that was
to
really
the
smart.
Line without going too far.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I appreciated how that was handled, that it was very, very overt and clear... but we didn't have to see it. We didn't have to, like, you know that she had experienced that.
Right.
She, you know, booked it straight out of there, you know, didn't stick around to see what would happen. And then didn't put herself in a situation, like, to be alone with him again.
Which
she was like...
She was like,
now that I know this, I'm not doing that again. Like, done. No chance.
Awesome.
But yeah, I appreciated how that was handled.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Because I was, we all got concerned at the same moment during the sex scene.
I felt the whole room.
The whole room went, oh no.
He's like, be quiet, be silent. I want you
yes,
to be silent.
And we all were like, oh no.
Because we were introduced a scene earlier where Strickland is having sex with his wife. And he just wants silence throughout the whole process.
Yeah,
because
he wants her. He's pretending that
it's Eliza.
And it's even worse too. Because in the beginning of the movie, Strickland gets his two of his fingers bit off on his left hand. I think
left hand.
And they reattach the fingers, and they're trying to see if them reattaching and sewing up the tendons will like give him control of his fingers. But they just get more and more like fetid and decayed as the movie continues, which is symbolism. But he's in during the sex scene with his wife, she's just like, your disgusting hand is bleeding on me, and he's like rubbing the decaying fingers on her face, and I'm like, God, that's so horrible.
I know, he's like trying to cover her mouth with those
with
like dead fingers.
Oh,
and I'm like,
God.
Oh God, if I was her, I would
stop
be like,
it.
out of my face. So gross. We all had the same moment, but it ended up being okay. Not okay, but you know what I mean.
We got you.
Yeah.
And who has sex with their pants around their ankles like that?
I know. Honestly, take your pants off and take a real talk. One of my biggest issues with movie sex is how many, and I, you know, in some movies PG-13, you know, I understand why.
Yeah, but this was.
But in movies where you're gonna show nudity,
go take it off.
I do not understand why people constantly have sex with just like, we're just gonna pull our pants down and do it, and yeah. it's not how real people have sex.
And it's not even like they were in a rush. They were at their house. Yeah. The kids had gone to school. They had all the time in the world to take the rest of those pants off, and they just didn't. Yep. It didn't
take
make any sense.
Take a stronger stance, my guy. Like, your form is bad. Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
This is what this, this movie has done.
But that's not
podcast.
The sex you came here for. Let's get to the part
to the part where we talk about the fish sex.
She boinks the fish.
So back at the apartment, Giles discovers the amphibian man. I'm going to make it one word. Devouring one of his cats.
Aw, that poor cat.
I know, the poor kitty.
Pandora.
It was Pandora, and I was so sad about it. But, I mean, and the guy was right not to blame the amphibian man.
I thought
he
that
didn't
was
know.
Really cool.
That he was like, it's okay, he's a wild creature. I'm not going to blame him. Yeah. I'm just going to keep an eye on him now, you know.
And ultimately, the amphibian man makes it kind of, rectifies his wrongs a little bit.
Well, and it's hilarious. It's hilarious later when he's petting the cat.
He's petting the cats, and he's like, don't play with the cats. Get away from the cats. And the amphibian man's like, oh, okay, I'll get away from the cats. But yeah, startled, the amphibian man slashes Giles' arm and runs out of the apartment. He gets as far as the cinema downstairs before Eliza finds him and returns him to her apartment.
Watching a movie in the middle
of
the cinema.
Yes, he's standing in the middle.
Bipedal, standing there, wide stance, just looking at the screen. It just...
Eliza comes in. She's like, "Boss man, what
you
doing?"
She's like, "What you doing, bro? We gotta go upstairs."
You good?
He's like, "Oh, I just wanted to catch the flick."
He's like, "Yeah, you know, this is playing. It was cool." So the creature touches Giles on his balding head and his wounded arm, and the next morning, Giles discovers his hair has begun growing back and the wounds on his arm have healed. Eliza continues to develop her romantic relationship with the amphibian man, culminating in sexual intercourse. And I cannot tell you how much I love the scene between her and Zelda the day after she and the amphibian man had sex, because she goes up and like she doesn't even have to sign anything or say anything. She's just all smiley, and Zelda figures it out and is like, "Did you actually?" And she's like, "Yeah." And Zelda's like,
"She's like, how?"
And she like shows her like with her hand. Like,
there's
it
a
goes
visual
like
representation.
And it goes like that.
Yeah.
And Zelda was like, okay then. Like, and she's not even judgy. She's just like, all right, like, good for you,
like,
girl.
You know,
like, you get yours. Like,
yeah. You ride that fish.
That is a supportive friend.
Ride that retractable.
No, no, John.
No,
John.
No.
Family friendly.
Family friendly, John.
Why are we hating on John? I've said like way worse things throughout the podcast.
I don't think you have. That's a step too far.
Yeah, we can't talk about the... But we can talk about riding fishmen.
No, we cannot.
Yeehaw. Cowboy.
I may just have to put this one as E just to be safe.
Yeah. I would recommend
I'm going to put this one. We're going to have to get the E on
E
this
for
one.
For everyone.
Just to be safe, since John said riding the fish man.
I didn't
John
say
did
riding,
said the riding the fish man.
I well, cut hey, him off it, before he could say something worse.
Well, hey, John, since I'm going to be putting E anyway, you're going to be the first purposely uncensored cursing of banner box, because if a bucket is E, then we don't have to.
No, man, fish sticks are crazy.
Oh my god, John!
I said fish sticks.
Fish sticks.
Fish sticks, man.
Dicks.
Oh gosh. Okay, we're moving on. So General Hoyt unexpectedly arrives and tells Strickland he has
in another incredible
that's
scene.
Another great scene of just him absolutely putting him in his place and telling him you don't have the power you think you have. He said he has 36 hours to recover the amphibian man or his career and life will be over. I don't know if that means he's going to shoot him or like execute him or what that means.
I think it just means that he will be, I think... I think that Strickland sees his job and his career as his life, and I think that's Hoyt effectively telling him, look, you're going to become unimportant, you will be kicked out of all of this, your career that you've built for yourself will be gone, and you'll just be left with the scraps.
And
that's
see,
what I took
at
out.
At first, I thought that's what it was, and then he kept going about how he himself would not exist. And I was like, is he saying he's going to kill him?
No, I think it's metaphorical. I think it's all metaphorical.
I actually have a thing for that. Okay. So if I may put on my little tinfoil hat for a brief moment, apparently when it comes to the American government, instead of disappearing people and killing people, if you are a scientist or some kind of worker who's working on like top secret confidential stuff that you're not allowed to expose to the public, like aliens Area 51, which I completely believe, if you are exposed to that and you tell anyone and the FBI or the CIA or whatever finds out, they don't do anything to you, but they will ruin the financial stability of you and everybody that you know and love. They trash your credit, they take away all your assets, and they do it in a way that's like really, really subtle. So if that's what they were alluding to, he's alluding to this is top secret, and if you botch this whole top secret operation, not only are you going to lose your job and all of the resources provided that allowed you to get that Cadillac in the first place, right, and you're going to go under there, but we're also going to just like make your life a financial nightmare. Which is what they allegedly have done before to certain scientists who worked on an Area 51 spacecraft that was on H3H3 podcast. Anywho,
Majestic 12. Again, it just shows the how fragile everything Strickland holds to value. It just shows how fragile it is.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
No, you're totally fine. It just it paints like how easily, like, everything that, you know, the toxic masculinity holds in such high value is so easily stripped from their fingertips.
Because clearly his family isn't what he holds that in. His physical health isn't what he holds that in with his fingers. Because he lets it get to the point where they are rotting while attached to his body. It's pretty much just his career and the power that his career gives
him. It's power. It's just power.
It's a power trip.
The day.
It's power. It's drive.
Oh, Lord.
Anyway, Dwayne Johnson. Confirmed.
Hey, Dwayne Johnson, thanks for tuning in.
Oh, Lord.
The one thing I do want to say about Strickland, though, is that I was really kind of like moved by his whole speech about, I've known you for 13 years. I have not failed you a single time.
Mm-hmm.
I am a good and decent man. If I take the L on this one, does that am I just in the annals of history a failure? And as someone who's messed up a thing or two in his time, that really hit home for me. I actually agree with him. Like, no, he shouldn't be considered a failure. And he's just like, not only will you be a failure, but we will ruin your life. And I'm like, I'm triggered.
I thought the same thing. I was like, this is interesting because it's like, I don't like this character, but I've not I haven't been where he is, but I've been in a situation where I have felt like that,
Mm-hmm. Again, from his standpoint, he has a point.
Yes. He has a point from his standpoint.
Right. It just shows what the power structure in that particular type of economy and government, what was rewarded.
Is still rewarded. Because, you know, if you screw up, like if you've done years and years and years of good work, and then you have a, like, decently big screw-up that costs people money or costs people an asset you're going to immediately, like, you're done, goodbye. And it's like, no second chances, no nothing, goodbye. And that's a cruel, cruel world we live in. But meanwhile, Hofstetler is told that he will be extracted from the U.S. in 2 days. Although the planned release date approaches, the amphibian man's health begins to deteriorate. Hofstetler goes to meet his handlers, and Strickland follows him. At the rendezvous, Hofstetler is shot by one of his handlers, but Strickland, in turn, not only shoots and kills both handlers, but also shoots Hofstetler, having realized that he is a spy. I'll just say this. I'm not someone who necessarily wants to be on the team against Strickland at any point in time unless I have an amphibian man with me. Strickland tortures the dying Hofstetler into revealing specifics on the team which broke out Amphibian Man.
They just clean.
I know. He's sitting there like, what team? What are you talking about? The strike team! It's like, what strike team? Strickland threatens Well, hold on. And Strickland is surprised to learn that Eliza and Zelda are implicated. So then Strickland threatens Zelda at home, unsuccessfully, until her husband Brewster reveals that Eliza has the amphibian man.
Here's the thing. From Brewster's standpoint, I get it as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wasn't angry with Brewster, but yeah, I got why Zelda was.
Brewster's trying to protect his wife.
Yeah, but Zelda is trying to protect her friend. Yeah. And so, like, it's all... No one is necessarily in the wrong here, yep. except for Strickland.
I was really hoping, though, that Brewster was going to... In another world, my favorite scene in this movie is when Strickland walks in and starts talking to Zelda and completely ignoring Brewster, and Brewster stands up and beats the crap out of him. I was really hoping that was going to happen.
Right.
After talking about Brewster and their relationship, you know, the entire movie, I was really hoping Brewster was going to stand up because he was a big guy.
Yeah,
he was going to stand up and just grab Strickland and just absolutely put him in his place, and that would have been beautiful, and I'm kind of sad they didn't do that.
I mean, it also tests to the power structure that racism kind of held in that time period.
But just imagine how awesome that would have been.
No, it would have been fantastic, and I would have loved to have seen it. But that's the whole point, is that that's how strong of a hold racism had.
Yeah, because it also would have immediately raised the question of, like, oh, God, Brewster beat up a white man. He's going to die.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's acknowledging the circumstances that you're in and trying to survive and get by within those circumstances.
Yeah, for sure. But no, that scene was awesome. It just showed, again, how, like, Zelda may not be a good liar, as she said, but she is, like, a dutiful friend. She is not going to back down if the person she cares about is being threatened. But Zelda immediately telephones Eliza, warning her to release the creature. An enraged Strickland ransacks Eliza's empty apartment until he finds a calendar note revealing where she plans to release the amphibian man. At the canal, Eliza and Giles are bidding farewell to the creature when Strickland arrives, knocks Giles down, and shoots both the amphibian man and Eliza. The amphibian man quickly heals himself and slashes Strickland's throat, killing him.
After Giles delivers a hell of a 2x4 to the face.
Oh, yeah, he smashes Strickland in the face with the butt end of a 2x4.
Yeah.
Just destroying that man.
A direct, like, nose shot, too.
Yeah. It was right into the face. There was a big, like, blood spurt.
I think the entire room physically just went, ooh.
We were all like, oh, God.
I don't want to get hit in the head with a 2x4.
No, but Amphibian Man, he does his little healing thing.
His little glowy, healy thing.
Yeah, he does his glowy, healy thing, and then he goes and in perfect...
You really are a god.
Yeah, and in perfect poetic fashion slices Strickland's throat so that he can't make any sound as he dies.
Mm-hmm.
Which I love it. I love some poetic justice. As the police arrive on the scene with Zelda, the amphibian man takes Eliza and jumps into the canal where he heals her. When he applies his healing ability underwater to the scars on Eliza's neck, they open to reveal gills like his. She jolts back to life and the two embrace. In a closing voiceover narration, Giles conveys his belief that Eliza lived happily ever after and remained in love with the amphibian man.
In reality, though, I don't know if the human body is... put together for life under the sea.
Well, clearly Amphibian Man's got some crazy abilities. So
hopefully he can also make her cold-blooded and impervious to pressure.
I'm sure he can.
Otherwise her brains turn into mush and she's getting hypothermia.
He literally died and came back to
his
healing ability.
I'm so cold all the time, fish man. This was a bad call. Can we please go to the Caribbean?
Well, that was The Shape of Water. What would you guys rename this movie? Don't.
Oh, boy.
Don't do what I know you're going to do.
Don't
do it.
It's the meme from Wheel of Fortune where it's F blank S-H. Or what is it? It's blank blank S-H.
No, it's blank I-S-H L blank.
That's
blank,
right.
Blank.
That's right. And it was supposed to be wishlish. And he's like, ding, fish love. And they don't even say no. They're just giving a beat. And he's like, I'm sorry. Is it fish love?
I mean, it's kind of lame, but it's just out of water.
Yeah. Out of water.
Fish love out of water.
No!
Fish love out of water. The sequel.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, ooh, I would...
Fished. Fished.
So, I know a big thing back in, like, the 50s and 60s was the idea of the ideal man and the ideal woman and, mm-hmm. like, you know, how you present yourself. So I would call it the ideal man.
Ooh. The ideal man is a fishman.
The ideal man is...
Catfished.
Oh, no. This is falling apart at the seams.
This podcast.
This is one of my favorite episodes.
BFD.
Oh my gosh.
What were you saying?
BFD.
What is it? Oh.
No. All right, John, bring us
oh,
home.
Oh, Lord. This is a difficult one. Come back to me and I will interject with.
All right. Well, whenever you have one. Because
we're already done with
ours. Yeah, we're done with ours. So.
Oh,
we're
y'all are accepting my joke answers? Perfect.
Well, I mean, unless you're coming with a real answer.
That's what you got to do sometimes.
This joke answers is the way. No. Like, God's honest truth. Of all the segments that we have on this show, the one that I've been very consistently terrible with is this game specifically. Because I'm with all of the projects that I've ever, like, taken a hand at writing at, it's always, like, title to be determined. Or just, like my D&D world is set in Solas. What is it? It's the Tales of Solas. Shut up. I can't think of anything more clever. I'm sorry.
Well, do you have it?
I think so. And it's not great. I'm going to call it Boiling Over.
Boiling over.
That's not bad. You know what? Bad. Okay, I have something. It's not a meme. Just given that
fishmen love eggs.
No, not that fishmen love eggs. I don't know. For I don't even know why I'm saying this. I think I'm just gonna call it Point Break.
No, Tyler. Oh,
I'm
God.
Sorry, John.
I knew
valued member to the team. And I love you.
I knew you were gonna do it eventually, but I will say I respect that you let it on as though it was real. You even had the nerve to say this isn't a meme. Oh boy,
I'm sorry, John. I love you,
John. We'll never let you get over. Trolls 2 or Point Break. Those will never leave.
And we'll never let Russell forget Christian Bale.
No, we'll never.
Wait, what happened there?
We go, time to recast
this.
The movie. He goes, you know, Christian Bale.
And he was being dead serious. And we were like, Russell, it's with people at the table. And he was like, oh.
That's incredible. That's really funny.
Oh, Lord.
All right.
Well, I went on Amazon. General consensus by viewers is pretty all right. 76% rated it 5 stars.
That's a little lower than I expected.
Yeah, I mean...
Is that even picking up in the mic?
It might be.
That's a little lower than I expected.
Oh, Samuel. Yells from out of the room trying to still be on the podcast.
That's not how that works.
So, since Sam is taking a potty break, do y'all want positive or negative first?
Negative.
Yeah.
All right.
Even a positive note.
So most of these negatives I had to sort through because a lot of them were either gross, bestiality, bleh, or it was like just stuff that, or it was like so long and draggy.
I don't get why she's into the fish man. It's not even hot.
God, yeah, you're exactly.
Wrong.
Like
was gorgeous.
Like basically that. So like I had to really search. This one still isn't something it's not like, when I say it's not a negative review I like, I mean, I wish there was a better negative review to read, if
yeah,
it makes sense.
I got
but
you.
This was the best
one,
that I found.
One of more substance.
Yeah. But this was the best one I found. So this is from LV Dave, and it's titled No Redeeming Value, and this was in 2019. Truly the worst movie I've ever seen. The fact that it won Best Picture shows why America is in such a state of moral decline these days.
Oh my God.
We are being run by the greed and immorality of Hollywood. Anything goes because there is no longer a standard of truth and decency in that industry. Gratuitous sex with a fish man, gratuitous masturbation, a supremely evil character that makes you want to vomit, swearing, trash talking, very goofy movie. As another reviewer says, truly a B movie. I wish I could unwatch this movie. Watching this movie is as bad, or probably worse, is that possible, than listening to a State of the Union address by the Donald. Please, God, help me forget
what?
The evil of this movie. 1 star.
What the?
And that was the best one I found.
I'm over here like, oh, I know exactly who wrote this. And it's just like, and by the way, screw Donald Trump. I'm like, who's writing this? I'm like, you sound like... You sound this like close-minded from the 60s. And then it's just like, oh, and also this. And I'm like, what?
That little loop at the end there, gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. Threw us for a loop at the end.
Keep them guessing.
So this is a positive review. It's a little long, but I like it, so I'm gonna read it. So this is from Helen, and it titles "Could Not Have Asked for Anything More," and this was in 2018. My husband and I loved this. Perhaps the difference from some reviewers is that I enjoy reading the genre of romance, and basically this is an amazing romantic fairy tale. It had all the elements I need to enjoy a great, I don't know what this stands for, H-E-A. We have the sad and lonely heroine, the strong and supportive best friends, Octavia Spencer and Richard Jenkins, the tortured, in this case literally tortured, hero, and the unrepentant villain. Michael Shannon made a fabulous bad guy, really embodying everything vile. He was a horrible, self-absorbed, arrogant, racist, chauvinistic jerk, and it was enjoyable to watch him disintegrate, again, literally and figuratively, as the movie progressed. I always like the bad guy to lose big in the end. Some reviewers mentioned bestiality, but I think they are seriously missing the point here. This fantasy challenges us to rethink our own self-absorbed arrogance. Perhaps in thinking Eliza and the unnamed hero's relationship is disgusting, we are uncovering a bit of Strickland in ourselves. This movie has it all. Romance, action, dramatic angst, Russian spies, and even an old Hollywood-style musical scene. I could not have asked for anything more. 5 stars.
And HEA stands for Happily Ever After.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I did not know what that was. But yeah, I thought that was pretty good. I thought it was very accurate.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it summarizes a lot of my feelings on it.
Yeah.
And Helen was able to write that in a way that didn't take me waxing poetically for an hour. So that's really impressive.
In the future, we'll just use the Amazon review and that'll be our whole podcast.
We just read one review. All right, guys. Thanks for stopping by.
All right, guys. Bye.
That perfectly sums up our thoughts.
So, now to guess, what do y'all think this is rated critically on Rotten Tomatoes?
Ooh. I'm gonna say 89%.
Okay.
Watching
be a
9.
I think that's gonna be a little under.
It's gonna be 9.0 because he just cheated down. No.
I think that's probably a little under, but I also think that there's a possibility that a lot of people hated it.
And this is critical? Critically?
This is critical. Yeah. What did you say again, Samuel?
89.
9 point. This is out of 100.
Rotten
Tomatoes.
92.
Okay.
I'm going to take a swing and say 83.
You got it exactly, Tyler. It's 92.
Cheating works. God, that's the first win ever.
I swear, Tyler.
Now it's a meme.
Your first exact of 2022 is Shape of Water. So now the audience score, also out of 100.
I think this is going to be substantially lower. I'm going to say 78%.
Okay.
I'm gonna swing even lower, 75.
Okay.
There's no horses in this one, bud.
That's true. I can't use the horse. I can't use the horse method. John.
Eggs. Use eggs.
The egg method. How many eggs were there? There was the whole tray of eggs. I'd say rounded up, there's probably about 36 eggs that were shown in the movie. We all know double that, 72.
Got it exactly.
Get out of here! Oh my god!
I'm dead!
Oh my god! Cancel the podcast. You will never be able to top this moment. Oh my gosh!
I'm dead! Oh my god!
This podcast just needs to be titled Eggs.
That was the most... Oh my god, that was the most contrived shit I've ever done worked!
Oh god. Oh well.
Oh my gosh.
Well, now for the IMDb out of 10. God.
8.1.
Okay.
7.7.
Okay.
Who cares? I'm on the mountaintop. This is the audience or critical or
IMDb.
Okay, so I probably should learn how this stupid game's played. It's not stupid, it's a great game.
You said 7 point, what'd you say, John?
7.
Okay. 10.7, that's you said what?
He said 8.1.
I'll say 7.5.
You didn't get it exactly, but you are still the closest. It was a 7.3.
Wow.
Oh.
Wow.
Tyler sweeps.
I'm on fire.
Sorry, I'm writing this down because I don't want to have to go through and do these stats again at the end of the year.
No, understandably.
So I want to write it down.
God, that's stupid.
That's so stupid. Okay. So well, the budget for this one was $19.4 million, and it made $195.3 million.
Take, we take.
So it made good money, well, good money off of this.
Good for them. Very, again, I believe it won Best Picture, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did. Yeah. So I've got some fun facts here. So one day after completing her demanding underwater scenes for this film, Sally Hawkins flew to London to begin production on Paddington 2, only to find out that she would have to shoot underwater scenes for that film on the first day. So she didn't get to escape. She had to do the exact same things.
Oh my God.
So according to an interview with the National University of Mexico TV channel, Guillermo del Toro said that if this film had flopped, he would have retired from directing altogether. He stated as well that this was also the case with Pan's Labyrinth and The Devil's Backbone due to the deep personal nature of these projects.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I mean, I can only imagine how harrowing that must be to take a part of yourself and like really put it into a movie and or mm-hmm. to like an artistic project and it just not be received well publicly. I mean, yeah. I feel like that's a lot of Edgar Wright's. I mean, I feel like Edgar Wright would probably experience that to a degree.
I think a lot of recent M. Night.
Yeah.
Oh, he's on my bad list just for Avatar. I can't get over it. I know it sounds one note, but I mean, I don't that's like fair. That. But like Edgar Wright, in my opinion, as you said, Guillermo del Toro is one of the greatest. I think Edgar Wright is just absolutely prolific, and he just doesn't get the acclaim that he deserves, which is just a catastrophe. But Guillermo del Toro says some really good stuff, and he did well. And this isn't about Edgar Wright. Sorry, Edgar Wright. Thanks for tuning in. Really sorry.
Well,
go back and check out our what is that movie called?
I wasn't on it.
Dude, I don't know.
It's the early Edgar Wright.
Scott Pilgrim vs. the World? Yeah. I love that movie.
Well, this isn't one I wrote down, but like I said earlier, he, you know, pictured a lot of these actors, you know, already in mind. Sally Hawkins was not just the first choice. According to Guillermo del Toro, she was the only choice.
Wow.
It was going to be Sally or it was going to be nobody, essentially.
Wow.
So the genesis of the idea for this film began, as Guillermo del Toro explained in an interview, with reruns of the classic 1954 monster movie, The Creature from the Black Lagoon. Quote, I thought it would be great if the creature and Julie Adams, who plays Kay Adams in the film, would end up living together. I was 6, I didn't know better, but I'm 53 and I still don't know better because I made this movie.
Fun fact about Guillermo del Toro, he was originally supposed to direct and write the new Hobbit films.
What?
And he was still the executive producer of them.
Wow.
Oh.
But those were supposed to be his films, and then he ended up, I forget why exactly, I think because he wanted to do some stuff with them that the studios didn't like, and they basically demanded that Peter Jackson be brought back on to do them.
Mm. Get those were supposed out of to here. Be
Del Toro's films.
Interesting.
Huh. That would be...
That would have been different.
That would be very different.
So, Del Toro's breathing was recorded as part of the Amphibian Man's vocalization. So, some of the sounds we heard was him.
Directors doing that.
I don't know, ma'am.
Revenge of the Sith coming up.
One of Octavia Spencer's favorite things about the screenplay was the fact that by letting the main couple be mute, most of the dialogue comes from a black woman and a closeted gay man. In real life, they would both have experienced depression during the 1960s setting of the film, so they actually got a voice here.
Yep. That's really cool.
I thought that was really awesome.
That's really cool.
After seeing the trailer, Kevin Smith tweeted, "Seeing something as beautiful as this makes me feel stupid forever calling myself a director." I just thought that was really interesting.
Wow.
So director Del Toro first met Sally Hawkins at the 2014 Golden Globes and pitched the film to her while intoxicated. He says, quote,
that must have sounded crazy.
He says, quote, "I was drunk and it's not a movie that makes you sound less drunk." But apparently he still sold her on it because she ended up doing it.
That's incredible.
Most of the characters, again, were written with the actors in mind. Octavia Spencer said her character was reminiscent of a collaboration between her roles in The Help and Hidden Figures, and that she, quote, would have played the desk if Del Toro had asked her to.
Yeah.
And last but not least, this is we kind of talked about this in the article that we went over with the suit. Doug Jones spent 3 hours every day getting into the costume. According to him, though, it was nothing compared to previous costumes he had worn in other films by Del Toro.
No kidding.
Wow. So this isn't even the toughest one he's had, but this made a dancer double vomit immediately. So who knows? Del Toro apparently punishes Doug Jones all the time. So yeah, now we get to recast. So who would I mean, you're Strickland. I want you as Strickland. I'm already going to say that.
So fun fact, and this is...
I was actually going to put him as Hofstadler.
Really?
And I saw it at multiple points during the film. There were multiple little facial things that he did, very dry humor, where about halfway during the film I said, yeah, I want Tyler as Hofstadler.
Okay. Hofstadler, I appreciate it.
And also then... You can use the Israeli toys that you love so much.
The
Jewish toys that
Israeli
Europeans create that the Russians love so much.
All Europe is the same. The Israeli toys.
Well,
you
it's
love
the
so
line
much.
From the movie.
Uh huh.
It's the line from the movie.
It's the line from the movie. Dwarfish people
says.
Know each other, Samuel.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
The line
Sam's getting canceled.
I can't
believe
this
you
tune into this
Sam's
filth.
Getting canceled. Yeah. Oh boy.
So fun fact, I haven't been keeping an actual like numerical track, but and this isn't bad. This is not a critique. Keep doing it. I am almost consistently cast as the bad guy. Seriously.
Well, that's part of why I want you as Hofstadler, because it's different.
It is different.
It's different than I anticipated them saying Strickland, which I could see. But I would want you as Hofstadler.
I appreciate it either way. I'll be the perma villain, but I'll also be Dimitri.
I want John as Giles.
Yeah.
It's so funny that you said that, because I was thinking the same thing. Yeah. I think and you're laughing. I think you would do a really good job of being endearing.
John
like that.
Consistently underrates himself as a dramatic actor.
I agree.
Yeah, he does.
I agree.
But
you
could do a really good Giles.
And you know who I want to see? Who I would want to see opposite John? I would want Russell to be the guy
with the pie shop guy. Mm-hmm.
I think that dynamic would just be incredible.
Yep. Samuel.
I know.
Hi.
I kind of think Hoyt. General Hoyt.
Ooh, that'd be
I could
pretty
see
cool.
Hoyt.
That'd be pretty cool.
If Tyler's not Strickland, then out of the Mad Artists, I would put Brett.
Yeah, he could
do
that.
He would
do
really, really well with that.
I would put Brett as Strickland.
I would also love to see Samuel do the guy underneath Strickland.
Oh, that guy!
The
security guy.
I forgot about that guy.
Who's like?
Okay. Yeah.
He's like, I called it in. He's like, you.
The
what?
Very nervous guy.
Here's a question that I want to try and handle with some self awareness. Obviously, I mean, we've done gender bend roles before. How are we with like? Are we staying consistent with like race stuff? Because
we've done enough movies where most of the cast has been not white that we have just had to sort of say like if you
prefaced.
Were put in the role, like not like obviously we couldn't actually play the character
right.
because the character is of color, but but just like the personality, the character itself.
If that's the case and that everybody understands I'm trying to be sensitive towards that, but I would say Sam Marie would absolutely kill it as Zelda.
Oh, she would. Oh, 100%. She would.
And
I mean this as a joke and I love it. But Danielle would be a great Yolanda, but I mean that entirely as a joke.
I'm torn for you because obviously, you know, the female characters that you'd be really good for Eliza. I think moreover than that, I think you would freaking kill it as Mr. Fishman.
I know. I want to be the Fishman.
Yeah.
I think Danielle would be Eliza. I think Danielle would kill that role. That is not even a question in my mind.
No,
I play both.
Of course you would.
Yeah. I'm both.
Yeah, well,
I think
you'll
myself
be in the
half
suit.
Amphibian man, and then I'm half
you'll
just
be in the suit, so it won't matter. You could do both.
It's like that weird Halloween costume to wear like part of like the blow-up costume is like another person.
Yeah.
And you just have the little, your actual body is attached to the balloon body. So just,
I think John just had a stroke.
I'm with you.
I know what you're talking about.
There was a little dance at the end that none of our listeners would see.
No.
That kind of made it for like to try and articulate.
I know what you're talking about.
I'm a visual.
I would love to do both. Honestly, either
yeah,
one is a super great role. I'm down for both. So favorite and least favorite moments. I think I have mine already. If everyone else needs time to think,
please go right ahead.
I mean, I loved the Cadillac buying scene. That scene was fantastic. The scene where he's, you know, interrogating them, I love. But one scene that we didn't mention that I am obsessed with was where she is trying to communicate how emphatically she wants to break out the Amphibian Man.
Ooh.
And Giles keeps fighting her and being like, I'm not going to do this.
Really
I can't do that. And she has to get physical with him because she can't speak. It's
right.
Like, you know, she's grabbing him. She's kind of like hitting him a little bit. Like,
it's
you need to hear what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So she asks him to repeat back what she is saying so that like he actually has to like say the words,
mm-hmm.
essentially, and like hear it come out of his own mouth.
That's a really good point. That was a really
beautiful
moment.
And I loved that whole scene. It was fantastic. I was obsessed with it. I also loved the little Hollywood fantasy scene that she played in her head.
Yeah, the dream sequence was really cute.
Yeah, the little dream sequence. I really enjoyed that. I love a good dream sequence. Least favorite had to be him having sex with his wife and putting his bloody hand on her face.
Mm.
And then again with the hand ripping the fingers off and throwing him across the room. It's just because I hated the sound.
Yeah, that was
atrocious. I hated the sound so much.
In a great way.
Oh, yeah.
It got us to feel what we needed to feel, but
it just made me cringe through my whole body.
Hard. It was real hard. I would let Samuel talk first.
I was going to say, my favorite is hard. The opening was so good. It's hard for me to pick a favorite. It really is. The pie scene I loved that like kind of was the first time you see Giles and Eliza's friendship. That was a really good scene. My least favorite moment was a moment that really bothered me. We didn't mention it in here, so I didn't get to say it during it. But when she goes in to see the Amphibian Man, and he's being tortured by Strickland.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes and hides in the back while Strickland and Hoyt and Hofstetler and all them come in, and Hofstetler sees her and all that. There's still like four people in the room. Hoyt and Strickland leave, and she sprints out like behind the others. And I was like, and she sprints out into direct view of Hofstetler and a bunch of people in the hallway. I'm like, there's no way that people didn't see her.
Yeah.
There is just no way. Like, you could have found a better way to have her escaping that situation without her just running out in plain view of everyone.
Yeah.
It felt a little cutting corners to me.
Yeah. My...
In general, just all the there being no security cameras in there.
Right.
Just all the her getting away with it for so long kind of took me out
a
little bit.
I got you. My favorite was the first 10 minutes of the movie. The title sequence into establishing who Eliza is and her routine. I don't know. It was so stylistic. It was so enthralling. It set the tone perfectly. And I just really enjoyed that entire sequence a lot. It showed you in a tasteful way, hey, this is going to deal with sexual themes. This is going to deal with nudity. This is going to, you know, this is what her life looks like. This is her taking care of Giles.
Mm-hmm.
It did such a succinct job. She's friends with the guy who runs the theater. Like it was great. And I really like it had me hooked, and very few movies will grab me as much as that intro sequence did. I would say my least favorite, not even because it's bad as much as it's just what I got the least amount of enjoyment or visceral emotion from, would be the scenes where Dimitri is talking to the Russian, his like Russian managers, if you will.
That's fair.
Just because it accomplished what it needed to accomplish, but I was just like, yeah, whatever. Get back to the fish part. I want to see Lawrence Fishburne again on screen.
John?
I will have to agree with Tyler as far as favorite. The title sequence into the intro of Eliza's character was just beautifully done. I love Bioshock the game. It gave that atmosphere, which I loved so much of. I will say my least favorite moment was honestly eating the cat.
Oh yeah, that was awful.
Like, I think that's probably
across the board.
That was such, like, I get why it happened, but they could have gone about it in a different way that didn't need the visceral eating of the cat.
Yeah, we didn't need to see a headless cat.
Like, I get they want to sit there and have a reason for the fishman to go out and scratch Giles, so that way it can show that the fish has healing mm-hmm. properties. But they could have gone about that, like, he could have been touching one of Giles' paintings. Mm-hmm. There could have been a thousand ways he could have gone about doing that, to where that would scare the fishman to run out and scratch Giles.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like that's just Guillermo del Toro, though, trying to be like, look at this thing. You have to look at it. I will say, though, I would have died trying to kill a god if you did that to one of my dogs. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah,
I mean, Giles handled with poison grace. Tell you that much.
He's a more patient man than I am. Because Lord have mercy, I'd be like, you're gonna kill me, but I'm it's a big kitchen knife. let's dance, Mr. Fishburne.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
No,
I can leave.
Well, out of 10 Cadillacs, what would you rate this movie?
This is coming in hard for me at like a. I'd say 9. I'd say a 9.
Yeah.
Come back to me, because I'm debating whether it's a 9 or 10. Because this to me, there was not a single moment in this movie that made me go, I don't like it.
I'm gonna give it 8.5, and I'll tell you why. It was 2 hours long, and it still felt a little long to me. The pacing in the middle wasn't great. The first third was fantastic. The last third was fantastic. The middle, the story felt like it took a long time to develop without actually anything developing. Does that make sense?
It does, but I had the opposite effect. I mean, for me personally, you tell me it's 2 hours. I genuinely didn't know, because from start to finish, I was so here for the ride. And I thought, too, because like right at that moment... that was like, okay, let's pivot. Like, it's like, okay, we get it. You're establishing that you're good with Mr. Fishman. And right as I had that thought, it's like, okay, I'd like to move on. It moved on. Mm-hmm. No beats for me. Everything's subjective. For me, I felt was paced perfectly. It was like responding to my thoughts as soon as I was like, okay, maybe. And then it's like, you're right. We'll show you something else now.
Yeah.
Which was pretty cool.
I think I'm going to give this one, I'm going to kind of right in between, well, Tyler's supposed guess until he changes it, or decides to change it. Uh-huh. I'm going to ride on a solid 8.9. Again, like Samuel said, artistically, the first third and the second third kept the vibe and the ambiance of the movie that was initially established that we got from that intro title sequence. And it kept that, but there was a brief chunk where there was so much action that it kind of felt like a standard cut and dry, like 2010s adventure action film for a second, a little bit, which, you know, happens whenever you have that much content happening that you want to articulate accurately versus artistically. So that way nothing's lost on the audience. So I understand that. And there was just a few parts that just didn't click well for me, like the cat eating scene. I was like, okay, I get it, but also didn't really need to be there. But overall, I mean, I'd watch it again. You could say the rewatchability is on point.
So I've come to my decision.
Okay.
I'm going to give it a 9, and the only reason why I would take points off, because like if 10 is a perfect movie, I think this is as close to that. This is pretty darn close. I will say... I probably won't watch this again in a minute, just mm-hmm. because it's like it's made its point, and it's not like Die Hard where it's just like, ooh, action, Hans Gruber, let's go.
There's a level of artisticness to it.
It was a lot to take in, and I feel like maybe once a year or once every after a long swath of time, I'd be like, ooh, I would love to show X person this, you know, and then you watch that movie. Kind of like, we haven't talked about this ever, but there's a movie called The Lobster that is one of the most artistic movies I've ever seen. And that was such an experience for me. I'm like, I'm never watching that again because that was so overwhelming. But it was also one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Like, it was really strange. And I gotta, you know, not such a hard line, like, I'm never watching it again, but I wouldn't rewatch it like I would some of the other movies that I would give a score to.
Consistently watch it like 9. Every other week. Right.
Long way of saying 9, excuse me.
I think I would go probably close to where you are. You know, I'm going to put it a little higher, but still not like a perfect 10 for me, because similar to what you were saying, I'll watch it again, but it won't be for a while.
Right.
And whereas a lot of my like perfect 10 movies are things that I would happily put on, like, you know, even if it is, even if it is like, you know, a little heavier, like, you know, I gave a perfect 10 to I Am Mother. I'd watch that right now if we wanted to turn it on. I love it. It's fantastic. But I would give this, I think, a 9.5. I was very happy with it. I loved the vibe. I loved the acting, the story. Everything was great. I just, like, I gotta take off just a half point for the cat. And for, just because there is, like, a quality to it that doesn't make me, like, super thrilled to just go ahead and watch it again.
Is it the rewatchability?
It has John's famous rewatchability, but not for a little while. And I don't even think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's something that you just need to take a little bit to kind of like let it soak in before you go in for, you know, another try.
Like, rewatchability can
be cool as ice.
Rewatchability to me is just the fact that, like, you feel comfortable after X amount of time going back and watching the film.
Yeah.
For instance, I would never go back and watch 19 whatever Dr. Doolittle. Ever.
Yeah. That's because we don't hate ourselves, John.
So
one time was too much.
Have you guys seen the movie Silence?
Mm-mm.
Okay. It's Andrew Garfield,
I'm sold.
My love.
I'll watch it.
My boy.
That gorgeous baby boy.
I love him so much.
Well,
much.
We can go on an Andrew Garfield tangent after we close podcast. Out here.
We will. I was just going to say, to this point about rewatchability, Silence is another one of those movies where it's 3 hours long and it's just people getting tortured, but it's really beautiful for a lot of reasons, and I probably will never watch that movie again. Because it was like, thank you for making your point. I learned a lot. That was an incredible experience. Don't ever show me that movie again. Oh my God.
Yeah, there are some movies like that for me. I get that.
Yeah.
And maybe, who knows, maybe this is even kind of like that for me, where I'm like, I really enjoyed it. I probably won't watch it for, like, a few years.
Yeah.
If I'm being honest. But yeah, I think that is all we have for today. So just a reminder, we are starting our Star Wars series next week.
I am so excited. Phantom Menace.
Sam,
Samuel talk more than he ever has.
You will get sick of hearing Samuel talk.
Deets. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Going to learn about the living force.
Okay.
Midichlorians. Yeah.
Sam Whitworth Jr. over talk. Here.
The next all these Star Wars podcasts are basically just going to be TED Talks run by Samuel.
Pretty much.
But, and Tyler, let's not shortchange Tyler's ability to go in on some Star Wars.
He's correct, but I don't think any of our listeners had any concerns about me being quiet during the podcast. So.
That's fair. That's very fair.
According to Rick, that is not the case.
Just a reminder, y'all can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Mad Artists Entertainment and on Twitter at artists_mad. We are working on our second episode of Call of Cthulhu, so we'll let you know when we get closer about that. Tyler, give us whatever info you might have about Forced Comedy.
Forced Comedy exists and it's back, baby. We're going to be showing you some awesome stuff on Thursday at 8:30, same bat time, same bat channel. You can follow us on Twitch at Mad Artists Co. Give us a follow so you can stay up to date as soon as we go live for your favorite Twitch show on the platform and mine, Forced Comedy. Can't wait to be back so we can make some more headway with Undertale, also one of the greatest games of ever. You're welcome, people.
That's right, man.
We heard your guys' responses. We got just floods, countless emails and messages and Twitter mentions about how they wanted to bring Forced Comedy back. And I'm not going to keep it from you guys. If you want it that badly, I'll put it back on. So that's what we're doing.
I'm going to start having to have a taboo buzzer for when Tyler talks for too long, and I'm just going to buzz the taboo buzzer and then you have to stop talking. Well, y'all can visit our site for more information about all of that. It's the same thing as our Twitch handle, madartistsco.com. If you have any comments, questions, corrections, or requests that we should review in the future, or you want to hit us up like Rick did, you can message our social media or email us at banterbox.madartists@gmail.com. Leave a review wherever you're listening. That helps us out, and we will see you guys next week. Bye!
Fishmen love eggs!